Thank you for tuning in to the WOLA podcast, Latin America Today, and the Just the Facts podcast. It's Saturday, October 19th, 2013. I'm Adam Isaacson, a senior associate for regional security policy at WOLA. It's time for a week ahead podcast. A day late again, I'm sorry, but I was traveling in Mexico this week, just got back last night. I'm going to talk today about a U.S.-backed military offensive in a remote region of Peru, the capture of one of Guatemala's top narco-traffickers in Mexico, and a few big recent changes on the scene for human rights and the judiciary in El Salvador. But first, Peru. The U.N. Office on Drugs and Crime announced last month that Peru had displaced Colombia as the world's largest grower of coca, the plant used to make cocaine. Peru hasn't been the number one coca-producing country since 1996. Unlike Colombia, though, most cocaine in Peru does not go to the United States. Most goes to Brazil, Argentina, and Europe. The UNODC's coca survey found that Peru's largest coca-growing area, with about 20,000 hectares, or one-third of the country's harvest last year, is a region called the VRAE, V-R-A-E, which stands for the Valley of the Apurimac and N-A Rivers. This didn't come as much of a surprise. The VRAE, in an isolated area where the departments of Ayacucho, Junin, and Cusco meet up in the Peruvian Andes, is a historically ungoverned region that for years has been a stronghold of what remains of the Shining Path. That's the Maoist guerrilla insurgency that spread chaos throughout Peru during the 1980s and early 1990s. The Shining Path remnants in the VRAE are perhaps 300 fighters, if you believe their leader, Victor Quispe Palomino, alias Comrade Jose. They still spout the occasional bit of revolutionary rhetoric, but they're mainly dedicated to narco-trafficking these days. Their activities have made the VRAE today the largest coca-growing region on the planet. But Shining Path was largely left alone for most of the past 20 years in this region. It no longer posed a threat to Lima or other population centers, and it rarely ventured out of a few enclaves like the VRAE. In recent years, Peru's armed forces did make a modest effort to confront Shining Path in the VRAE. In 2009, during the presidency of Alan Garcia, Peru's armed forces launched an offensive in the VRAE that sought to push out the guerrillas and increase manual coca eradication, but the Shining Path appeared to have grown deep roots among the local population of coca growers. The guerrillas proved to be tough to push out. After they shot down two army helicopters, the offensive more or less fizzled out. The military left a presence in the VRAE, though, and since 2008, about 100 soldiers have been killed in the region, mostly by ambushes. The past few years' estimates showing increased coca growing in Peru have put pressure on the government to do something more about the situation in the VRAE. Peru's president, Ollanta Humala, a former army officer, has vowed to do more to control the VRAE and has put forced coca eradication at the center of a new counterinsurgency plan. Sometime next year, heavily armed police will be in the zone uprooting coca plants by hand. The VRAE offensive is being led by a joint task force combining Peru's army and police, who don't really have much of a history of working closely together on these things. This is at least in part the result of advice, training, and intelligence from the U.S. military, which have been increasing. U.S. personnel have also reportedly been advising the construction of new military bases in the valley. The government is preparing to expropriate 1,100 acres of farmland to build a large new air base. The Associated Press reports that the plan is to build 11 military bases and smaller posts in the VRAE region this year. Peru's anti-drug czar, Carmen Macias, is working closely with U.S. counter-drug authorities, and Peru may be the only Latin American country outside Central America that's currently seeing an increase in its U.S. military and police assistance. It's going down almost everywhere else in the region, but drug czar Macias isn't specifying any time frame for what's going to happen. She does say that the offensive in the VRAE is expected to get seriously underway next year. She insists that the coca eradication effort will not only be a military and police endeavor. Eradication on its own does not work, says Macias. Neither does development on its own. There has to be eradication and development. In an email to Global Post reporter Simeon Tegel, the U.S. Embassy in Lima said it was providing Peru this year with $100 million in counter-drug aid, $68 million in military police and eradication assistance, and $32 million for alternative development programs, including testing new crops and increasing their yields. On our Just the Facts website, which is our database of U.S. military assistance using the most recently available U.S. government documents, we came up with about $93 million in 2013 from all sources. So the aid for Peru has been revised upward over the course of this year. The U.S. support to the Joint Task Force in the VRAI is the largest assistance that the United States has given to Peru's army in a long time. For decades, most U.S. security aid has gone to the Navy, the Air Force, the police force. Really, since a 1968 coup that put a leftist army faction into power, the Peruvian army has said yes to some aid and training, but has kept a certain distance from the United States. Evidence of this is the army's equipment, aircraft, and weaponry, much of which come from Russia and other non-U.S. arms exporters. When interviewed by reporters, residents of the Varay region sound pessimistic, even cynical, about the upcoming offensive. Freddy Leonardis from the village of Otari told Tegel, "There will be serious conflict. There will be another guerrilla group, not like Shining Path, but a new one. No one is going to put up with having their crops destroyed. Of course people are going to rise up." Villagers in the area have spent more than a generation seeing almost no presence of their government, living off of coca and living alongside the Shining Path fighters. They tell reporters that they don't want the government building military bases in the Varay. An activist from Otari, Kezisate Atahualpa Capac, told Tegel, "As Peruvians, we support the armed forces in the U.S. to fight the narco-terrorists, but we have never given permission for this war to happen on our land. Residents worry that the offensive will be entirely military, and that the government will forget to give them assistance to feed themselves and to produce legal crops." Glicerio Rojas, a farmer from the village of Los Angeles, told Tegel, "We don't know what we will do if they destroy our coca. What am I supposed to feed my wife and six children with? We are just farmers. We don't make cocaine paste or cocaine." Asked if he would grow other crops if they could match the money they get from coca, he replied, "Of course. We would eradicate ourselves. We wouldn't need the army or police to do it. It would be magnificent." On to Guatemala, where U.S. security assistance to fight drug trafficking is also on the increase. On October 7th, in a ceremony held at a Guatemalan Air Force base, U.S. Ambassador Arnold Chacon delivered six UH-1Y Super Huey utility helicopters as part of a $40 million donation to Guatemala's Air Force and police. The Huey is an old workhorse helicopter, the same model that U.S. troops used heavily in Vietnam, and the ones given to Guatemala were built around 1970, but they've had a package of upgrades added to them recently. They've been being used in Guatemala for a while now, but until the October 7th ceremony, they remain the property of the U.S. government. These helicopters are mainly used for transportation. Each can carry about 14 people. The six helicopters together are valued now at $11 million out of the $40 million package. The United States gave Hueys and a nearly identical model, the Bell 212, to Colombia's police and army as part of Plan Colombia, and to Mexico's army as part of the Merida Initiative. Also included in the U.S. donation to Guatemala are eight armed vehicles, aircraft navigation equipment, infrastructure to house the helicopters, communications equipment, and months of pilot training. 14 Air Force pilots have been trained to fly the helicopters. Two more are studying in Miami, along with two pilots from the Guatemalan National Civil Police. A total of 18 pilots will get the training. In addition to Ambassador Chacon, the handover ceremony was also attended by Guatemalan President Otto Pérez Molina and his ministers of Defense, Interior, and Foreign Relations. Interior Minister Mauricio López Bonilla said that Guatemala will use the donation for operations to capture drug traffickers, among other anti-narco-trafficking duties. This donation is part of the Central American Regional Security Initiative, or CARSI, the State Department-managed program that has increased anti-drug and crime-fighting assistance to Central America since 2008. CARSI includes a counter narcotics aviation program specifically for Guatemala, which provided $15 million of aid in 2012. The aid is not for Guatemala's army, which is still prohibited from getting aid through the State Department-managed foreign aid budget because of human rights concerns dating back about 25 years. The Army can still get aid from Defense Department anti-drug accounts, but those accounts can't pay for new helicopters. Guatemala's police has already used four U.S.-provided helicopters in Operación Dignidad, Operation Dignity, a months-long activity in northwestern Guatemala. Operation Dignity led on October 4th to the capture on the Mexican side of the border of Francisco Eduardo Villatoro Cano, alias Guayacano. The 33-year-old Villatoro Cano is allegedly one of Guatemala's largest drug traffickers, the head of a drug trafficking organization based in Huehuetenango in Guatemala's northwest corner, and suspected to have links to Mexico's Cetas cartel. Guayacano is considered the mastermind of numerous murders in Huehuetenango, including that of Irma Yolanda Olivares, a public prosecutor in the town of Chiquimula near the Honduran border, and the June 13th massacre of nine police officers in Salcajá in the western department of Quetzaltenango. A group of about 15 armed members of Villatoro's gang murdered 8 police officers in the Asalcaja police station and kidnapped, then subsequently killed, the station's deputy director. Basing themselves on recorded telephone conversations, investigators hypothesized that the massacre was a revenge killing for the deputy inspector's theft of $740,000 in money and drugs from Villatoro's group. Operation Dignity was launched a month after the massacre on July 13th in the municipalities of La Mesilla and La Democracia in Huehuetenango, considered to be Guayacano's stronghold. Over the next 2.5 months, the police carried out 174 raids and arrested 40 people, 16 of them allegedly linked to Guayacano's network. On October 4th, 83 days into Operation Dignity, police from Mexico's Attorney General's office captured Francisco Eduardo Villatoro Cano in Tuxtla Gutierrez in Chiapas State, a short drive from Guatemala. The narco-trafficker was arrested while entering a medical center there, where he'd been undergoing plastic surgery to change his appearance. The Mexicos turned him over to the Specialized Division of Criminal Investigation of Guatemala's National Police. Guayacano is now being held in the National Police Hospital, where he's recovering from infections from his plastic surgery. Some critics have noted that it's strange to see the alleged killer of 9 police receiving medical care in a police hospital. Critics have also questioned why Operation Dignity focused on Villatoro Cano's network while ignoring what might be a bigger criminal group in Huehuetenango, the so-called Huistas cartel. While Guayacano is allegedly tied to Mexico's Zetas, who have had several of their top leaders captured or killed lately in Mexico, the Huistas cartel is believed to be linked to Mexico's Sinaloa, or Pacific cartel, headed by Joaquin El Chapo Guzman, against which the Mexican government has had fewer recent successes. Finally, let's look at El Salvador, which has seen a flurry of activity around its justice system and human rights in the past few weeks. First, the Salvadoran Supreme Court's Constitutional Chamber took a step that shakes up one of the foundations of the 1992 peace agreement that ended the country's bloody civil war and that probably has the armed forces on edge. On September 21st, the justices admitted an appeal that challenges the constitutionality of the 1993 law that amnestied all who had committed human rights violations during the civil war of the 80s, the military and police, the guerrillas, and the pro-government death squads. El Salvador's Legislative Assembly enacted the amnesty law on March 20, 1993, 1 week after the country's Truth Commission published a report detailing 30 cases of severe human rights violations committed by the FMLN guerrillas and the army during the war. The law prevented investigations into the massive amounts of murders, torture, disappearance, rape, displacement, and other crimes that have left tens of thousands of victims in El Salvador. Since then, the OAS, Inter-American Human Rights Commission, has urged El Salvador many times to eliminate the amnesty law. Last year, the Inter-American Human Rights Court considered the 1981 El Mozote massacre, when the Salvadoran army killed more than 800 villagers. The Costa Rica-based court invalidated the amnesty law and ordered El Salvador to carry out 14 reparation measures for the victims over the course of 5 years. The new challenge to the amnesty law comes from some of the country's leading non-governmental human rights lawyers, who, on March 20th, the 20th anniversary of the amnesty law, filed a petition to challenge the law's constitutionality. They argued that the amnesty was unconstitutional because it pardoned people without first even declaring them guilty of committing a crime. The law, the human rights defenders argued, also violates the Inter-American Human Rights Convention, to which El Salvador is a signatory, and they also contend that the law was approved 20 years ago via a process that itself violated Salvador's constitution. This isn't the first challenge to the amnesty law. In 2000, the Constitutional Chamber decided that the law is not applicable if the lack of an investigation is actually blocking victims getting reparations. But the amnesty still remains intact due to a requirement that all 5 judges must agree unanimously that it shouldn't apply to a case, and that hasn't happened. That requirement came from a decree handed down by the government at the time, which was from the Arena Party, a party that strongly backed the Salvadoran military during the Civil War. Today, though, the ruling party is the FMLN, the guerrillas who demobilized and became a party after the peace agreement. Over the years, both Arena and the FMLN supported the amnesty law, as both have members who benefit from it. But in recent months, the FMLN's likely candidate for the 2014 presidential election, Salvador Sanchez Seren, has been saying that El Salvador should repeal the amnesty. He and others who support repeal argue that doing so would reduce a widespread feeling of impunity that they argue continues to pervade El Salvador's political culture. They say that it would show the world that El Salvador is committed to stopping human rights violations and that it would give justice and closure to tens of thousands of victims' relatives. On the other side are those who argue that repealing the law and starting a series of human rights trials would reopen old wounds and threaten the country's 20 years of peace. But upon accepting the appeal, the court's justices gave El Salvador's legislature 10 days to deliver a report on the amnesty law. On October 2nd, the Inter-American Human Rights Commission put out a statement reaffirming its own rejection of the amnesty. The Salvadoran Supreme Court, which was reformed as part of the 1990s peace process, has been involved in a lot of conflict lately, as it's been exercising an unprecedented amount of independence through the amnesty decision, by taking on old human rights cases, and by issuing decisions that have gone against both ARENA and the FMLN. Another example occurred this past Monday, as the Constitutional Chamber fired the Supreme Court's Chief Justice. The justices decided that Chief Justice Salomon Padilla's position was unconstitutional because of his linkages to a political party, in this case the ruling FMLN. The Chief Justice, who was named in August 2012, spent part of his career as a lawyer in municipalities governed by the FMLN. He worked for Alba Petroleos, an oil company tied to both the FMLN and to Venezuela. And he never denied being associated to the former guerrillas turned ruling party. Opponents charged that Chief Justice Padilla was naming people linked to the FMLN, including politicians' relatives, to positions in the court. They feared that the Chief Justice would be inclined to find in favor of the FMLN in key cases, thus altering the balance of power between the executive and the judiciary. This balance has been strong. The FMLN has complained over the past few years that the court had been actively blocking many of President Mauricio Funes' appointments, including those of the Attorney General, the Defense Minister, and the Chief of Police. So the Chief Justice is fired, the FMLN is complying with the ruling, and ARENA politicians have voiced support for the move. Finally, any discussion of justice and human rights in El Salvador lately would be incomplete without a mention of the strange case of the Tutela Legal. This is the name of the legal aid offices of the Archdiocese of San Salvador. Archbishop Arturo Rivera y Damas, the successor of murdered Archbishop Vasco Romero, founded the Tutela Legal back in 1982 at the height of the country's political violence, and over the years, Tutela Legal has amassed an unparalleled archive of victims' testimonies about human rights violations in El Salvador. The office played a critical role in documenting cases, preserving evidence, and bringing abuses to light. It documented cases like El Mozote and the 1980 Sumpul massacre, in which Salvadoran soldiers killed 900 people in collusion with Honduran soldiers. The Tutela Legal was a crucial source of information for El Salvador's Truth Commission, and if the amnesty law is indeed overturned, the Tutela Legal's archive may again be a central source of evidence. So it sent shockwaves around Latin America when on September 30th, 9 days after the Constitutional Chamber agreed to review the amnesty law, the Archbishop's office abruptly closed the Tutela Legal's doors. Literally closed them. The Tutela's employees showed up to work on the 30th and couldn't get in, and they discovered they were all fired. San Salvador Archbishop José Luis Escobar ordered a group of security guards to block nearly a dozen employees, including lawyers and admin personnel, from entering their own offices. The Archbishop justified his move by arguing that today, 20 years after the conflict, the Tutela Legal has no reason to exist. A fired Tutela Legal lawyer, Alejandro Lenin, said that Archbishop Escobar, a conservative cleric, had been restricting the Tutela's work and opposed lifting the amnesty. Quote, "He is interested in having people with money get closer to the church," Lenin told the Salvadoran online newspaper Contrapunto. "And in order to save face with them, we think that he has closed Tutela." The response has been loud. 18 human rights organizations from the United States and Latin America, including WOLA, quickly sent the Archbishop a letter expressing strong concerns about the closure. President Mauricio Funes also went on record opposing the move. On October 15th, victims groups and lawyers asked the Archbishop's office at least to give them the contents of their archives relevant to the abuses that they suffered. Last Sunday, Archbishop Escobar appeared to back down a little when he announced that the church will create a new office for defending human rights. How this new office will differ from Tutela Legal isn't clear yet, though, nor is what will happen to the old office's archives. And that's it for now. Thank you for listening to WOLA's Latin America Today and the Just the Facts podcast. Please keep listening. We're up on iTunes, where if you have a moment to write a review, we'd really appreciate the feedback, and it would help us to reach new listeners. Meanwhile, please keep visiting WOLA's website, www.wola.org, and the Just the Facts website at www.justf.org. If you're finding these podcasts useful, please do consider making a donation to keep us going. You can also find both WOLA and Just the Facts on Facebook or on Twitter at WOLA_ORG and justf_ORG. Hasta pronto.